All right, we're going to begin this morning with appeal number 20-3272, United States v. John Johnson. We're going to begin with oral argument from Mr. Leonard.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Mike Leonard on behalf of Mr. Johnson. We're here seeking reversal on two grounds. One, that the district court erred in failing to dismiss the indictment based upon the existence of a non-prosecution agreement, and secondarily, that the district court erred in not dismissing the indictment based upon prosecutorial misconduct in the form of repeated discovery violations, including the loss of crucial information from the U.S. Attorney's Office as well as from the detectives. This case starts with certain unrebutted facts. Mr. Johnson was told from the inception by the Decatur detectives that he would not be charged for his 2014 conduct, which is the whole gist of our motion. In addition, from the outset, he was told that there was federal involvement. He was told specifically, and this is unrebutted, that there were a lot of hoops to go through to get federal involvement. He was also told at that same time at this first meeting that detectives had already reached out to federal authorities in the form of reaching out to U.S. probation, Ms. Powell, and talking to her about his cooperation. It's important also to note that from the inception and throughout Mr. Johnson's dealings with members of law enforcement, he did not have counsel at any time. And that is something that's a distinguishing feature from this case and all the other cases relied upon the government, because I don't think in a single one of them did the individual at issue who was claiming there was a non-prosecution agreement not have counsel.
Mr. Leonard, with regard to the agreement. Initially, there's an oral agreement, then there's a written agreement. I think it was from 2016. At one point, there's an argument that the written agreement is a formality or a formalization of the oral agreement. Do you agree with that argument or disagree with it?
Well, the word formality is true, Your Honor, because what happened was when they call Mr. Johnson in, he's already months into his cooperation. So if you remember, the first meeting I just spoke about was December 2015. When they present him with this document, we're into March of 2016, and his testimony at the evidentiary hearing is unrebutted that he's already been cooperating, doing work to try to make the three deals. So you're right, they do present him with a written document. It's not, in my view, a formality of what they've already agreed to, but what they tell him, the document is a formality that he must sign it. And there's no testimony at that evidentiary hearing that they went through the document with him, advised him to seek counsel, told him he had the right to seek counsel.
So your argument is the two agreements are separate, not connected?
Correct. Because, you know, even if we're standing in the shoes of Mr. Johnson at the time and look at what his reasonable belief was and whether there was a meeting of the minds, if you look at that agreement, it's cited on page 7 of the government's brief. It is a lot of legalese, especially paragraph 6 of the agreement, which seems to take away paragraph 5, which says, hey, we can't make an agreement not to prosecute you. That's with the state's attorney's office. But then they go to section 6. So even if he had been charged with reading this without counsel, I don't know how he would have concluded that he still didn't have a deal with the Decatur authorities and the federal authorities at that point in time. And I do note, Your Honors, that in the government's brief, they say that the detectives went through that agreement you're referring to, Your Honor, line by line. That was not part of the record. That was not presented at the evidentiary hearing. It was not considered by the judge. And that was an affidavit submitted by Detective Jones prior to the hearing. They made a decision not to call any witnesses on the issue of whether the parties reached an agreement. I understand there was, at that hearing, a sort of agreement they wouldn't go on to decide whether there was a breach, but the government very well could have called witnesses at the hearing to rebut anything that Mr. Johnson said, and they didn't. So all of Mr. Johnson's testimony was found not only to be credible, but as unrebutted. And the government suggests in their brief that the district court made some credibility findings with respect to Mr. Johnson. The district court never, in any of the hearings, called into question the credibility of Mr. Johnson. What the district court did was make a ruling as of law that it wasn't reasonable for Mr. Johnson to rely upon the representations, and therefore, as a matter of law, the federal government never agreed to a federal non-prosecution agreement. But the way this case is different than all the cases cited by the government, chiefly the Lilly case. That's the case they always come back to, which is the 10th Circuit case. And I think Lilly's a good case for this court because it kind of represents the typical situation that's confronted when a court is evaluating a non-prosecution agreement. In Lilly, like many of the cases, including this district, the individual who's defendant, who stood in the shoes of what Mr. Johnson finds himself in now, was dealing with local law enforcement authorities, also dealing with the DEA, and representations were made to him by local law enforcement and the DEA that he would not be prosecuted. The court in Lilly found, well, that's not enough because there's no evidence that the U.S. Attorney's Office was involved in those negotiations. And that's very different than this case because we have at every step of the way federal involvement. Not only at the beginning where they tell him there's going to be federal involvement, but there's more. As we know, Gwen Powell, who's a probation officer, she then goes and communicates directly with the assistant U.S. attorneys at the time. I think it's USA Baum. He agrees. They all agree to sign off on this deal. They don't instruct Ms. Powell to say to Mr. Johnson, who at that point they know does not have counsel, hey, make sure Johnson knows that this does not include an agreement not to prosecute federally, which they easily could have done. Instead, they let Ms. Powell, who they knew would communicate with Mr. Johnson, go back to Mr. Johnson and make the representation to him that the U.S. Attorney's Office had signed off on the deal. And we know from Mr. Johnson's standpoint, when he was given the deal in December, there was no limitation. No one said to him, well, we're not going to charge you from a state standpoint, but you can be charged federally. So you had the U.S. probation involvement at that point, and the court might say, well, that's not enough. But what makes it also different than Lilly and these other cases is that Ms. Powell's notes reflect the fact that her understanding of the deal was the same as Mr. Johnson's, that there'd be no sentence and that he would not be charged. And what's important is that not only does Ms. Powell communicate with the U.S. Attorney's Office, it's undisputed that the detectives, the local law enforcement from Decatur, they too actually meet with the U.S. Attorney's Office and get their sign off on this deal. Again, it would have been quite simple for the U.S. Attorney's Office, who they knew were going to go talk to Mr. Johnson about this deal. It would have been very easy for them to tell the detectives, hey, make sure you tell Johnson that this deal has nothing to do with federal charges.
Mr. Leonard, did they get sign off on this deal, which is the language you've used, or sign off on his ability to cooperate with the Decatur police while he was on supervised release?
Well, that's
and what do you have that shows the distinction there?
Sure. Well, all that they have in their records and Ms. Powell records are them agreeing to the deal. Okay? They don't make any limitation. For instance, they don't say to the detectives or to Ms. Powell, we're only going to agree that he won't be charged from a state standpoint. We will not charge him federally.
They also don't use the language the deal. So we have to
correct.
I would like you to be a little more specific.
We could call it the agreement. What they're presented with from the detectives are an agreement that, hey, we have Johnson on 2014 buys. We're not going to charge him. Will you allow him to cooperate with us? That's the most we can say is what's been explained to the U.S. Attorney's Office at the time. Likewise, Ms. Powell from the record explains to the U.S. Attorney's Office that, and her notes and emails are more broad in that she just indicates that he won't be charged, he won't be sentenced. She doesn't make any limitations on state or federal. So they're both presenting a deal or an agreement to cooperate to the U.S. Attorney's Office. They're not making a limitation about whether it only relates to state or federal charges. And in turn, what I think is more significant, whatever happens in terms of those communications, what's more important, I believe, is that the U.S. Attorney's Office, knowing that both the detectives and Ms. Powell are going to go back and communicate the discussion to Mr. Johnson, as they must and as they said they would, they don't come back to Mr. Johnson and say, hey, look, we have the sign-off from the U.S. Attorney's Office and from Ms. Powell and from Judge Baker, by the way, but just so you know, it's limited only to state charges. No limitation is ever brought back to Mr. Johnson. And as we know, there's no dispute. The beginning of his discussions with Decatur was that he would not be charged at all. It wasn't limited to state or federal or excluded federal. So that's what takes this case out of the mainstream of all the cases, including Lilly, because we have a case where the U.S. Attorney's Office is actually involved and knows about the cooperation agreement or proposed cooperation agreement. The U.S. Attorney's Office knows that representations are being made about what it is saying, what it is agreeing to, and they're allowing both detectives and Ms. Powell to go back out into the world to Mr. Johnson and make representations to what they're agreeing to.
Let's assume there is some type of an agreement, just for purposes sure. of discussion. Why don't you speak to the authority that these individuals had to enter into such agreement, including whether there was any such authority to bind the federal government?
Sure. In terms of the authority of the Decatur Police Department, I don't think there's ever been a dispute that they had the ability to enter into agreement to cooperate with Mr. Johnson. The government's never contested that below in the evidence you're hearing. They've never contested in their brief. So I don't think there's any evidence that says they weren't authorized to do that. So I would argue that the record's reflective of the fact they posed that authority. It's never been questioned on appeal or below. With respect to Ms. Powell, I would agree with you, Judge, that as a probation officer per se, she doesn't and can't walk around making deals. We would all agree with that. However, when she presents a cooperation deal to the U.S. Attorney's Office in this situation and specifically discusses it with them, and they tell her that they agreed to the deal and allow her then to be the communicator on their behalf, I believe she does have the authority that they've given her. They put her out there sort of in an agency role saying, hey, we're going to allow you to talk to Mr. Johnson and communicate to him that we agreed to this deal. So I would argue
Urso,
that
though, the Urso case says the person, federal government can't be bound by apparent authority. It's got to be actual authority. And the probation officer would be a representative of the judicial branch versus the executive branch. So we even have a separation of powers question here, don't we?
Sure. Well, I would argue, Judge, even if you found that to be true and this was an unauthorized agreement, I would still point to the Lilly case, which is seminal from the government's argument. And in the government's brief, they argue that essentially, while the court rejected in Lilly the idea that there's any fallback arguments, any sort of due process arguments, that's not true. Lilly specifically states in its decision, to be sure, we acknowledge that some of our sister circuits have recognized an exception to this rule of actual authority when the government's noncompliance with an unauthorized promise would render a prosecution fundamentally unfair. So that's an exception to what you're talking about. Even if this court were to find that Ms. Powell or the Decatur detectives were not in a position, they didn't have actual authority, it's a sort of due process fundamental fairness doctrine that would cause there to be an exception. And we believe that exception's appropriate and unique to this case. The reason they didn't apply it in the Lilly case and say, we're gonna find that no one had authority, but yet we're gonna enforce the deal, is because in Lilly, the court relied upon the fact that there really wasn't any federal involvement from the branch you're talking about, Your Honor. There was no U.S. attorney involvement in that case. You had simply local law enforcement, and then you had the DEA. You didn't have any involvement whatsoever from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Lilly. But more importantly, Lilly also, I'm sorry.
When you talk about a due process fairness exception, are you saying this rises to the level of equitable immunity?
Well, the courts have said that the doctrine, and we're kind of parsing words, but this court has said too, that equitable estoppel or waiver doesn't apply. But what Lilly calls it is a fundamental fairness doctrine. They're not talking about the concept of estoppel or waiver. They're calling it a fundamental fairness doctrine that's been recognized by various circuits. And for two reasons in Lilly, they didn't apply that, but I think that case differs in two respects, the one we were just talking about. But secondly, it was very important in Lilly to the court, as it is in most of these cases, that the individual who was bargaining with the government or agreeing with the government had counsel, Mr. Johnson did not have.
Do you want to address the most important thing you want to say about Brady before
I do.
You lose
I do
time?
Have 3 minutes for rebuttal, but I would like to say the two things that
Actually,
matter.
You're using up that time now, but go ahead.
Okay, I will do that. The two things about Brady that I think matter the most, and I would concede, especially based upon some recent Seventh Circuit case law, including the Barr case that they cite, this court has taken the position that it really doesn't matter if you don't get the materials. I don't agree with that, but it really doesn't matter if you don't get the materials timely, if you ultimately get them and can put them to use. But there's a fundamental difference between that case and this case. The government says in their brief that essentially the Rule 16 Brady issue doesn't matter because, number one, they got everything they wanted, which is not true. That's the fundamental difference. Is in this case, AUSA Miller conceded to the district court that they, quotation marks, lost all of the emails during the relevant time period. Why?
I'm going to ask you to finish up.
Yeah, because they... I'm using my rebuttal time though, right?
You already have.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I thought I had 3 minutes. Okay, I'm sorry.
You did, and it starts at the 3 minute point.
So the two points are they lost all of the emails from the U.S. Attorney's Office during the relevant time period. And secondarily, all of Detective Jones's files were intentionally shredded because the U.S. Attorney's Office did not do their job, put a litigation hold on, and get those documents. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leonard. We'll now hear from the government, Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, counsel. Eugene Miller on behalf of the United States, and we ask the court to affirm the district court's finding that there was no federal immunity agreement in this case and that there was no Brady violation. We disagree with many of the facts alleged by the defense here that they claimed were unrebutted, and really to start at the beginning is to understand how this case took place. And I think the court does understand. This is a defendant who was on federal supervised release. He sells drugs while on federal supervised release. The Decatur Police Department wants to use him to cooperate. And so they approach him. At that time, they weren't even sure if he was on federal supervised release or not. He, being sophisticated, tells them, you know, I'd like to cooperate, but I need to get permission to do that, because he knows he needs to, for my probation officer, because I'm on federal supervised release. So that's how this starts. And so he contacts, and the Decatur Police Department contact the probation officer about whether he can cooperate. And that decision obviously has to be made by the district judge. And so that's the proceeding that's taking place. It's simply that as part of the process, the probation office will consult with the U.S. Attorney's Office to see if they're going to object to the defendant's supervised release being, in essence, modified to permit the defendant to cooperate while on supervised release. And in this case, what they did, the probation office sent an email to the U.S. Attorney's Office that said the Decatur Police Department, actually John Johnson, would like to cooperate with the Decatur Police Department. We, the probation office, have no objection. What's your position? And the AUSA at the time, Baum, said, I have no objection. And ultimately, the response was, clear, although the defense claims it was unclear what it was. It was very succinctly stated. The United States Attorney's Office said, we have no objection to John Johnson's request to cooperate with the Decatur Police Department. So there's nothing in a communication to the probation office that there's not an objection to the defendant's request to cooperate that would suggest transactional immunity or any agreement not to prosecute. After that, as the record shows, the probation officer went to the judge, Judge Baker. Judge Baker also said, I will allow him to cooperate while he's on supervised release. And this, just to be clear, this is not unusual. This is something that will occur on a regular basis. And so then John Johnson was cooperating with the Decatur Police Department. The U.S. Attorney's Office was not involved in any way other than to not objecting to the modification of the terms of his supervised release.
This is not unusual for law enforcement and for the U.S. Attorney's Office and for state prosecutor's office. But does the fact that Mr. Johnson was not counseled separate this case, as Mr. Leonard has suggested in the briefs and here at oral argument, from all others? And does the government, or ought the government, have some sort of obligation to make sure the terms of any cooperation at any level and the limitations are clearly understood by a defendant, and particularly one who is not represented by counsel?
I would suggest the cases say there's no legal obligation to do that, although we certainly always want defendants to understand the terms of their agreement. And in this case, there was a written agreement.
There was a written agreement between the Decatur 3 to 4 months after the cooperation
That's not exactly correct. It was 3 or 4 months after they first approached Mr. Johnson. If you look at the emails, it took a while for the process to go through for Judge Baker to allow the defendant to cooperate. So when the agents went back to John Johnson to have him, then he was approved to cooperate while in federal supervised release, they brought the written agreement. So really, when his cooperation started, it started under the terms of this written agreement, which Detective Jones testified. They said that the defendant's testimony was unrebutted, but that's not correct. Detective Jones testified at the sentencing hearing that he went over that agreement line by line with the defendant. The defendant himself admitted at the evidentiary hearing that he signed it. He just said that he didn't read it. So the only written agreement that exists made it clear that there were no promises regarding the prosecution of any offense.
There was testimony that when the officers approached him in December, they told him the cooperation, they had to know now. He had to make the decision now. So you are saying that it didn't formally begin until months later when there was judicial approval, but this process started for Mr. Johnson in December of 2015.
It did. The decision whether he was willing to cooperate with authorities. That's right. That decision started, but no one told him at that time that he would not ultimately be charged for the two sales of cocaine he had made on supervised release. And in fact, the probation officer testified that she told John Johnson that he was going to be, even cooperating, he was going to be have his supervised release revoked for selling drugs while he was on supervised release, even if he cooperated. Now, John Johnson testified that wasn't true. He testified that both the detective and the probation officer told him that he would never be prosecuted. Of course, this was years after the fact while the motion was pending. And the judge, hearing his testimony, hearing the probation officer's testimony, found that there was no evidence that there was any federal agreement not to prosecute. And I would disagree with something in defense that it was said the government could have called more witnesses. The judge, after that testimony, made that finding on the record. There's no agreement to not to prosecute. And the United States then still wanted to call Detective Jones to testify at that hearing, and the defense objected. The defendant objected, and the judge sustained that objection and said, well, it's not relevant to have him come testify at this point. I've already found there's no agreement. Whether he breached the agreement or not doesn't even matter because the state agreement, because there's no federal agreement. And I think that dovetails into the fundamental fairness argument. This argument, the cases that the defense has cited really are discussing use immunity or fundamental fairness to using a defendant's statements against them, where a defendant makes statements under perhaps their reasonable belief, even if mistaken, a reasonable belief that those statements would not be used against them. That's not this case at all. There's no discussion of using the defendant's statements against him. He sold drugs while on audio and video to a DEA confidential informant. That case is what he pled guilty to. It had nothing to do with the statements he made later regarding the drugs that he was still obtaining from a source in Chicago. So in this case, there's no fundamental unfairness to the defendant in that he was not promised federal immunity, and whatever steps he took after he spoke with Detective Jones, nothing was used against him after that. The only thing that was used against him was evidence that was obtained long before he was ever approached by the Decatur Police Department. So we go back really to the legal principle, which really is what controls this case ultimately, and what Judge Mim found, which is that only the federal prosecutors, the U.S. Attorney's Office, can convey an agreement not to prosecute or transactional immunity, and that is simply not here.
Further to that, if we find that sovereign immunity trumps apparent authority, what is the remedy for a defendant who could be deceived by state officials into believing he's been promised federal immunity? Is it just on the defendant to know, I got to talk to a Fed? If I'm talking to a Fed, then I could get it. If I'm not talking to a Fed, then I can't. What's the potential remedy?
Well, I think these remedies are in those other cases we see. For example, if believing that he would not be prosecuted, he makes statements, right? Then the court could step in and say, well, those statements aren't going to be used against him because he acted in reliance, reasonably acted in reliance on promises that were given by the state authority.
But several of those cases are, in fact, about transactional immunity and not use immunity. And those defendants were found not to have been, not to have earned protection.
Not to have earned protection. That's right. That's correct. That is the legal principle. But I was responding to the question as to what, where could the court step in when it feels like there is significant overreach, perhaps intentional conduct on the part of the government. That's not this case at all. I mean, in this case, the judge found that no one, not state authorities, not the probation office, not the U.S. Attorney's Office, promised the defendant that he would not be prosecuted. It also found that if they had, which he found they did not, that they could not bind the U.S. Attorney's Office, which clearly could not have promised immunity to John Johnson, as the U.S. Attorney's Office had no contact with John Johnson, and he acknowledged the only contact he had was with the Decatur Police Department and then with his probation officer, who he'd had contact with throughout the time he was on federal supervised release. And then the court went further and even found, hearing all the testimony, being in the position to observe the demeanor and manner of the defendant when he testified, the manner and demeanor of the probation officer when she testified, he even further found and looked at the record, all the probation officer records that were admitted into evidence. He found that, in fact, the defendant could not reasonably believe that he would not be prosecuted for those prior sales.
Can we move to Brady?
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Miller, why did it take 2 years for the government to ultimately turn over everything? There were at least two instances where Officer Powell responded to the U.S. Attorney's Office and said, I have material, I have answers, and it took months for follow-up. There was one instance where she herself took two months to respond, or 3 months, but for the most part, most of that delay in the record, contrary to some statements by the government during the course of litigation, was on the U.S. Attorney's Office. And it took multiple attempts, and then finally the district court giving the U.S. Attorney's Office a two-week turnaround to get the final bit of information. And isn't that the sort of dilatory conduct that really does impair a defendant's due process rights?
Well, first to respond, we would, in the position we've taken, is that the information that the defendant requested is not Brady material. And moreover, the initial information that the court is discussing is information that was in the possession of the probation office, which were judicial records, which was required a court order to get. We actually did reach out to the probation office, and they would not turn over records without a court order. And then the defense filed, without any objection, in fact, concurrence of the United States, a motion for that information. Then those judicial records were turned over at the same time to both parties, the defense and the United States Attorney's Office. And then that information was in the hands of the defense at the time of the evidentiary hearing. And in fact, what they said was, after having, I think, about a month before the evidentiary hearing, is when they then said right before the hearing, we're going to file a motion for sanctions, but if you will agree to dismiss the indictment, then we won't file the motion. And the position of the United States was, that's not, you know, our position is that we are going to continue to go forward because there is no federal immunity. And then they filed a motion. Then, after that motion was filed, it was then at an additional hearing that then they requested additional new information. If you look at their discovery request, which was filed at the end, those all related to information concerning, now it said, the defendant's cooperation and his breach. Before, they were requesting information under their theory that we want all the information that relates to a non-prosecution agreement. Well, none existed. None ever existed in this case. So then they switched the tacks, and they wanted information related to the things that the defendant had been doing while he was cooperating, and the information on other investigations that related to the defendant's continuing drug trafficking activity that breached the cooperation agreement. So this was all new and additional information. And the United States actually does not believe, as we stated in our objection to the district court, that it was discoverable information, but we did provide it all. It included the request, internal U.S. Attorney's Office emails. Those are clearly not discoverable, but we turned them over to the judge in camera. The judge provided several of those that he thought were, I guess, relevant, even though they were not discoverable, to the defense, and the judge concluded that all of that information worked against the defendant. It showed that there was no agreement not to prosecute. And we agree with that. I believe that those internal emails showed that as well, but that they were, as a matter of policy, internal U.S. Attorney's Office deliberative emails are not discoverable, and we certainly couldn't take the position that they should just be turned over because they happen to be favorable to us in this case. So that was our position. But as Judge Mims succinctly found, ultimately all the information was provided to the defendant. He points to no information that would be favorable that he didn't have.
What about the final two categories that counsel noted in his reply and then again today? The emails from the U.S. Attorney's Office that would have been purged because of the three-year purge policy, and then Detective Jones's file.
Well, the lost emails he refers to are the emails that the probation office had. So that's the probation office turned over those emails. Just it was basically the brief email where the United States Attorney's Office says, we have no objection to John Johnson's request to cooperate with the Decatur Police Department. So they had that. And then as for Detective Jones' phone, it is true, he said intentionally destroyed, that agents, as many people do, I believe he was on his third phone by the time this case got to the point where they were requesting.
I was referring to his notes. He says he when he finishes a notebook, he destroys his notes. After some time, he wasn't under an obligation from you all to preserve anything.
And if you'll let, they corrected that in the sentence here to make it clear. That was before, though, that John Johnson was charged in our federal case. If you go back and look at the record, he just, that's what he did routinely. It wasn't until after the evidentiary hearing that the defense, in fact, requested information related to the defendant's breach of the agreement. That's what that information was. That information was what he was doing to cooperate and what was the investigation that showed that he breached the agreement. And I would say that goes to fundamental fairness as well. Ultimately, we never got there because there's just clearly on this record no federal agreement not to prosecute. But if there had been, the defendant, whatever that agreement was, the defendant clearly would have violated that agreement by continuing to engage in large-scale drug trafficking while he was supposed to be cooperating with agents. There certainly is no issue of fundamental fairness in this instance.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you as well, Mr. Leonard. The case will be taken under advisement. Thanks to both counsel.